Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Hold up.
Abolition of repression. Bill Gates. Friends, comrades, brothers, and sisters, greetings. There can be no serious consideration of the subject of prison abolition in America without reflection on the work of black feminist scholar, activist, Dr. Angela White Davis, who in 2003 published Is the Prison Obsolete? By Seven Stories and Open Media Press. Her work is the uber text, the forerunner of works on the abolition of the oppressive spectacle of prison, especially in the era of mass incarceration. Early in her text, Professor Davis recounted her memories of the early 60s, a period of American history when black radicals were imprisoned for their work in the Black Liberation Movement, among which was Angela Davis herself. She wrote, "When I first became involved in anti-prison activism during the late 60s, I was astounded to learn that there were then close to 200,000 people in prison. Had anyone told me that in 3 decades, 10 times as many people would be locked away in cages, I would have been absolutely incredulous. I imagine that I would have responded something like this: as racist and undemocratic as this country may be, remember, during that period, the demands of the civil rights movement had not yet been consolidated. I do not believe that the U.S. government will be able to lock up so many people without producing powerful public resistance. No, this will never happen, not unless this country plunges into fascism." That's the insight and vision of Dr. Angela White Davis. My thinking really tracks hers, for as one who came to consciousness during the 60s, the explosion of the prison population was quite unthinkable. But history sometimes takes unforeseen forks in the road, leading us to unforeseen destinations. The notorious drug war, launched by the late President Richard Nixon, was the toll gate leading to this unprecedented road to perdition by way of mass incarceration. His call for a drug war had immense impact on millions of lives and predominantly black and brown communities. It is ironic in the extreme that the U.S. is now undergoing another unprecedented drug crisis, this time by an explosion of opioids like OxyContin and fentanyl, drugs more powerful than heroin. But the addicts are largely white and rural, and their drugs are lethal. According to recent published reports, some 70,000 people addicted to these drugs die per year in the U.S. But the drug dealers wear white coats and have pain prescriptions to service their drug clients. These drug users, unlike those in the ghettos of America, aren't treated with derision or contempt. They are treated with loving compassion. And they, if they survive, aren't sent to prison. They are asked to enter rehab clinics instead. The movements that emerged from the rebellions of Ferguson, Missouri, have reemerged in the Black Lives Matter movement, and many BLM affiliates have embraced abolition to address the issue and the rigors of mass incarceration. In Pennsylvania, we've seen the rise of a state-wide movement called Decarcerate, which is today fighting for release of thousands of lifers in state prisons. These activists, many of them young enough to be the grandchildren of the 60s generation, are continuing the long struggle for freedom by dismantling the tentacles of mass incarceration. But we are now at the emergence point of that movement, not its end. Sadly, there is more work to be done. Auf Wiedersehen from Imprisoned Nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Starting a war, screaming peace at the same time. All the corruption and justice, the same crimes. Always a problem if we do or don't fight and we die. We don't have the same right. What is a gun to a man that surrenders? What's it gonna take for someone to defend her? If we all agree that we're equal as people, then why can't we see what is evil?
The time. Destruction of minds, bodies, and human rights. Stripped of bloodlines, whipped and confined. This is the American pride. It's justifying a genocide, romanticizing the theft and bloodshed that made America the land of the free. To take a black life, land of the free, to bring a gun to a peaceful fight for civil rights. You are desensitized to pulling triggers on innocent lives because that's how we got here in the first place. These wounds sink deeper than the bullet your entitled hands could ever reach. Generations and generations of pain, fear, and anxiety. Equality is walking without intuition, saying the protector and the killer is wearing the same uniform. The revolution is not televised. Media perception is forced down the throats of closed minds, so it's lies in the headlines and generations of supremacy resulting in your ignorant, privileged. We breathe the same and we bleed the same, but still we don't see the same. Be thankful we are God-fearing because we do not seek revenge. We seek justice. We are past fear. We are fed up eating your because you think your so-called black friend validates your wokeness and erases your racism. That kind of uncomfortable conversation is too hard for your trust fund pockets to swallow. To swallow the strange fruit hanging from my family tree because of your audacity to say all men are created equal in the eyes of God, but disparage a man based on the color of his skin. Do not say you do not see color. When you see us, see us. We can't breathe.
Times we have to come out of America to heal, to be places where we're not always the victims, we're not always in protection mode. And being in Africa right now, whether it's temporary or long term, I feel myself healing. I'm starting to see black people who are loving unity.
Rashad McCurry is part of a growing group, Black American Expatriates, who say they have experienced some form of anxiety, anger, and depression due to systemic racism, police brutality, and economic inequalities in the U.S., and chose to pursue a better quality of life abroad.
You know, in America, I refuse to have police friends no matter what the ethnicity is. And it comes from the system. I'm starting to see that people can have altercations and it doesn't have to turn into violence. That law enforcement isn't a villain. You know, there's so many things that I'm starting to see in a different light that's actually making me more of a whole person, showing me what reality is and actually showing how at sometimes diabolical systematic injustice is in America because it has us thinking all out of whack.
There aren't official stats to track this type of migration, but stories like Rashad's demonstrate that the idea of leaving the U.S. has gained more traction among Black Americans within recent years. It's clear that more black people are beginning to rethink their relationship with America.
It's like now I'm on the outside looking in. Like what they say about a bad relationship, you're in a bad relationship, but you don't know it because it's all you know.
In order to better understand the concept of leaving the U.S. for a life not stricken by systemic racism, I talked to Tiffany Drayton, author of the new book, Black American Refugee, Escaping the Narcissism of the American Dream, about her family's immigration to America and the racism that facilitated her move back to Trinidad and Tobago in 2013. Having escaped a toxic romantic relationship with a narcissist, Drayton recognizes the same unhealthy behaviors in her relationship with America. America, of course, being the narcissist, and Black Americans as the abused partner in the relationship, the imperfect and protracted love story. Tiffany shares her perspective on the existing state of the U.S. and whether the American dream is attainable for Black Americans.
We are looking at the current predicament of the United States of America, whether it be the astounding inflation, whether it be being on the brink of all types of calamity with war, in Europe, it's a frightening moment for anyone to think that this concept of the American dream is attainable. You know, when people are buried in student loan debt, especially Black women, the list of issues is just so, you know, unending. And it seems as if at this moment, so many things are unraveling. So the question of the American dream being tenable or attainable to all Americans is really starting to come into sharp focus. And a lot of people are saying, how can I afford a house if the price of housing is absolutely absurd? You know, how can I afford a life at all? And that's something that all Americans are grappling with. And then when you add to that the layer of systemic racism and you understand things like wealth disparities, then you really get to understand just how damning it is for Black people in the United States of America and our ability to have this social mobility and economic mobility that even whites more frequently can grasp. You know, in the larger context, it's hard for everyone at this point, but for Black America, it is especially difficult.
Something that really resonated for me while reading the book was the love bombing aspect of America and its relation to Black people and or immigrants. Please explore the idea with our listeners, because it's really an excellent way to describe this, you know, same or similar toxic relationship that many Black people have with the United States.
Yes, well, at the time that I started kind of working out my book, I also simultaneously was working out this kind of really toxic relationship that I was in with, you know, a very narcissistic, abusive relationship. And in exposing myself to healing from and ultimately leaving that relationship, I really recognized that abuse has cycles, and that abuse cycle kind of became a lens through which I looked at everything. And all of a sudden, you know, doing all of this work that I had been doing for all these years about racism, I was like, wait a minute, this is exactly how I felt in the United States of America for my entire life. And so this idea of love bombing, which is that first part of the abuse cycle, it's when the abuser meets the victim and they sell all of these tales and these narratives about, you know, you're made for me, you're perfect for me, we're going to have the perfect relationship, everything is so amazing. That's that initial phase of the relationship. And when you think about the United States of America and how it sells all of the narratives around itself, like we're number one, we're the best, we're this, we're that, you know, and immigrants come here and they can build themselves up and you can pull yourselves up by the bootstraps. Anybody can be rich. Anybody can be a millionaire, right? All of these narratives kind of makes us really committed to and invested in that relationship. And I really wanted people to understand that that is a tool of abusers, and it has a name, and it's called love bombing.
You know, I really like the idea of love bombing. You know, for me, it's this constant love narrative that we have with America, the love and hate relationship. We understand how toxic it is, yet we constantly are working towards, you know, voting America into its promise or protesting America into some level of consciousness, even to the point where we till the land with the expectation that something fruitful will grow eventually. And the fact of the matter is that it should, yet we also understand the nature of America. Are you suggesting that more Black Americans need to become clear with the reality that currently exists regarding, quote unquote, the toxic relationship, and then also figure out an exit strategy, much in the same way you did with the self-imposed exile?
Yes, you know, I think that once one becomes aware of the damning nature of narcissistic abuse, primarily the fact that these abusers seldom change. Like, it's not abusers like the power, they like the control, and the mechanisms by which they exert that power and control are sometimes so clandestine. It's like you wouldn't even necessarily know it's happening to you. So you may think things are changing, right? And that's part of, once again, the cycle of abuse. Like, you think, oh, things are getting better. Oh, Obama was elected, so everything is going to be great. And then all of a sudden you get this backlash and there's white supremacist groups sprouting up everywhere, right? So to really answer your question about becoming aware, like once you are aware that of the nature of an abuser and what it means to be victimized, you really can't turn your back on that anymore. You're like, no, I'm not going to let anybody treat me like that. No, I know my worth. I know my value. And that's where we as individuals, as a collective, reclaim our power. And in doing so, the exit strategy from a relationship like that is our collective power, because leaving is an option, right? You can go to another country. You can have your nice online job and make some US dollars and continue to live out a beautiful life around all people of color. I can't tell you that's not a bad thing for me. It's a fantastic thing for me. But when we understand like the scope of white supremacy, I really urge people to know and to really reflect on the fact that it's going to take more than that for us as a diaspora, for Black people, for African people all around the world to truly reclaim their dignity in this white supremacist system that we must eradicate ultimately.
When we speak of white supremacy, and the system itself, the nature of how it exists, I say it's long-reaching, because many times we only will focus on what's happening in the United States. And I say this as Black Americans, but when we think about the nature of it and its function, it's impacting the world, right? And I have an uncle, he's Nigerian. One thing that he says is that Nigeria exists in the state that it does because its biggest resource, its people, have been outsourced. Therefore, the intellectual promise is limited. Do you also see white supremacy destabilizing the promise of other African countries based on its ability to trick us into staying in this toxic relationship? Because we're just focusing in one particular area, but that's also connected to what you're saying around we need to eradicate it. We need to eliminate it based on the tentacles of racism. Talk a bit about that.
Yes, you know, that goes to the idea of brain drain. And pretty much brain drain is when you have a country and everyone leaves that country that's educated because they believe that they can have more resources or have more access to resources in another country. And that's what America has been doing historically for a very long time. You know, you take the best and you take the brightest and they pretty much come here hoping, you know, to make good on the promise of a better life. And as a result, all over the world, people, societies are hurting. Even in a place like Trinidad and Tobago, you could have better governing structures. You could have stronger communities, etc., if there was not as much brain drain. And the same could be said for any African country, for any Asian country where it's losing its brightest and its best to the promise of, you know, European and Western in general, self-betterment or that promise, that false promise. So it's like, I do envision this kind of reverse pattern where, and you know, I don't even just see it with Black folks. I'm actually starting to even hear it from a lot of European people who are in America where they're like, you know, here isn't really that much better. Like economically, you have to be pretty much a millionaire by this point to live on the East Coast and afford to buy a house. Like, I mean, to get a house in the ghetto, you need $300,000 right now. That's what a two-bedroom house is going for in Greenville, Jersey City, where my mom was living in the hood. And it's like, what level of absurdity is this? Like, how can anyone, and especially if you're coming to the country with not, you know, that many resources, the dream of that upward mobility may have ended, you know, back in the 80s, back in the 70s, when it could have been realized to at least some extent. You know, but for us younger folks and for this new generation, the trade-off, it just isn't worth it. Because yeah, you come, you lose your whole culture, you lose all your friends, all your family, more than likely, or you have to wait until they slowly trickle their way over here. And for what? You're still broke. So a lot of people are just not willing to make that sacrifice anymore. And some people who have been making that sacrifice for years are starting to question, well, is it really worth it? And are the returns going to be as great as I imagined they were? And for some, the answer is going to be, no, it's not. And they're going to take their butts back home. But beyond just that concept of people leaving America, I think it's really essential that we also focus on Black folks building like a globalized, like we have to be committed to a global idea of like a diaspora building, because in doing so, we can strengthen our communities and our countries and work from there. Because without that, it's going to be a pain, because transition is not easy. And what we're going through right now as like a global village is a real moment of reckoning that is going to require a serious amount of resources, both intellectual and both actually tangible, like material, and also like a commitment to a new way of viewing the world and where we should live and who we should live with and how we should be building our communities, where we should live, etc.
How do we make it sustainable? And I ask in the sense that, you know, many times we may visit these various places, say going back to Africa in particular, in my case, it would be Nigeria, right? My experience might be different than most because I have family there, but the thing for me that is always the ongoing narrative is that there's particular comforts that I'm accustomed to here in the United States. Going to Nigeria, my dietary needs or habits that I'm accustomed to here in the States won't be met there. May sound selfish, but the reality is that many of us have become accustomed or spoiled in regards to our access to things here in the U.S. But there's been this conversation, this talk amongst Black expats about investing in neighborhoods that they're moving to or escaping to, creating a business. So when other Black Americans or other Black expats visit, it might be more familiar to them. We're talking about dining experiences. We're talking about, you know, their shopping experiences and so on. But yet then there's the conversation of not existing as colonizers either and oppressing the people that exist in that particular community. Maybe if you can talk a bit about this conversation that's been happening.
Yeah, you know, I really want to contextualize it to you know, the year 2022, when the idea of sustainability should pretty much be at the forefront of everyone's thinking, and not just with regards to Black folks, but with regards to, I would say, just about everything. You know, there's a reason why we're seeing massive inflation right now. There's a reason why we're seeing the deterioration of so many systems. It's because they weren't sustainable. It's because our global supply chains were not sustainable. It's because the democratic processes, let's put quotes on that, were not sustainable. So ultimately, we are at like this crossroads moment, or this huge reckoning with the insustainability of this era of capitalism and mass production and the way that we looked at the world, the systems that we erected to kind of the foundations of our society were so unsustainable. So at this point, we have it's so necessary for people with the resources to be thinking about how they're going to impact their communities in ways that just inherently make them more sustainable. And that's where you're seeing all of these amazing ideas crop up about community farming. And that's where you're seeing big push for cleaner, renewable energy and actually making it so that African nations and nations in the Caribbean actually have renewables. Because ultimately, if we are bringing the future to other countries through our ideologies, through our resources, our connections to resources, then we're not just colonizing, we're investing. And I think it's essential that we're thinking about the future and what we want the future to look like. And for me, that is something that I'm committed to trying to build, even in a place like Trinidad and Tobago, or for, I would say, not just even, but especially in a place like Trinidad and Tobago, because I love my people, so what I gotta do? But I know that there's so much work to be done, and not just from a standpoint of preservation, but to actually preserve our culture, our way of life. And so I think that that's like the real beauty of this moment. It's so disruptive, it's so frightening. We have no idea what's going to come next, but once we know what the issues are, at least we're working on building something different and addressing them.
Tiffany, at the beginning of the book, you wrote, quote, "I write this from exile," end quote. Exile is a state of being barred from one's native country for political or punitive reasons. When you said exile, when I read that, the first thing that I thought was, say, Jean Bertrand Aristide, the former Haitian president, Lavalas leader, who was forced to flee his homeland. You weren't exiled in the same way as Aristide. So my question would be, Why would you describe it as such? And then two, what was the intended purpose for the reader? Because you mentioned very clearly exile as well as refugee, hence the title Black American Refugee. What was the intended purpose in that? What was the intended purpose and point of that?
You know, it's... Ooh. The concept of being in exile is so powerful in that it automatically lends itself to the idea of an act being very political. And the reason why Black people speaking very clearly about oppression, about systemic racism, Black people moving people away from these systems of oppression and challenging those systems. If anyone knows history, they know that's an inherently dangerous act. It's just not something you do and you sit around and you think you're safe. For me, as a Black woman, the list of dangers, the host of dangers that are presented to me just in my personhood and just by demanding acknowledgement of my personhood forces me to have to be realistic about the dangers of just being honest. And it's very sad, but being Black, being educated, being a woman is one of the most political things you can do. Educating people, it's one of the most political things you can do, especially as you see climates begin to shift and change. And everyone is surprised at the outcome of Roe v. Wade. But I've been afraid just to exist in America for pretty much as long as I could remember. So the idea of exile and refugee, these two words, and they really capture the fear that I feel because I know what I do is dangerous. And I know that participation in America and living in America and having my belief systems, you know, they just don't really go together. I'll put it that way. It's just a matter of time before someone doesn't like it and takes note. And the louder you are, the larger your platform grows, the more you organize folks, the more dangerous it becomes. So ultimately, I aspire to not having to engage with a system that is a threat to my very existence.
Talk a bit about this targeted experience you've had regarding the United States. And also I'm thinking like it's all encompassing of the mental health part as well, because I know so many Black women, Black professional women that suffer from depression or some level of mental illness. Can you speak directly to that and how it relates to this experience of being targeted?
A return to America for me always means a sinking back into a reality that makes me sick to my stomach and makes me depressed and makes it difficult. It's like everything just gets cloudy. It's like everything just gets cloudy and dark and sad. And it's like a fight, a constant fight. You know, I say it's like sprinting a marathon. That's what my American life is like. It's like sprinting a marathon. And the more I leave and return, the clearer, the more clarity I have in just how much anguish that return is. And a big part of the reason why I'm like, oh man, I don't know if I can survive this is on the mental health side, because it's like you're having all of these detrimental experiences. And then, I mean, who do you really turn to talk about it? You're so isolated, and that rings back to the idea of being in this abusive relationship, right? The one thing an abuser always wants to do is isolate their victim. And they don't want anyone to believe their victim. They want to control the narrative. And we don't understand. We are living in a constant state of that. So when we say we are being oppressed, when we say, you know, we have to have things to point to prove it to the society. And you'll say, look, listen, Black women are being oppressed. Look at the infant mortality rate of Black women, and look at the maternal mortality rate of Black women. And it'll be like, Yeah, well, that's because they eat too much fried chicken. You know, there's always an excuse for the trauma that we are forced to endure and for the absolute dehumanization of us and our families. So to that end, it's a big part of it is that every time I come here, I'm so alone and so in the fight. Every time I'm in America, I just don't want to have to see if there's a point at which I wouldn't even survive it. Like, I may not. Who knows? So I don't judge folks for getting to a point where they're just exhausted, where they don't know what to do anymore. What I will say, though, back to that word community, back to that word sustainability, back to the idea of healing and self-healing and recognizing abuse. Once you see it for what it is, you start to rebuild that community. You reconnect with Black people and Black women. You empower one another. You find ways to share resources. And all of a sudden, things get a little bit brighter again. And that's what we have to do. And that's why I really, really wanted people to understand the cycle of abuse. So we understand, no, it's not us, it's them.
Well, with that understanding that it's them and not us, right? What do you say to someone listening to this conversation that might be thinking, hey, Tiffany, capitalism, patriarchy, and some forms of racism exist in Trinidad and Tobago, that leaving the U.S. won't make you immune to racism or patriarchy? And I say this in particular as you frame it as a Black woman and that things are very difficult. And someone might be listening to me like, okay, what are you escaping when these ills or isms still exist in other environments? What's your response to that?
Yeah, you know, I with frequency speak about the impact of the white gaze and just having to be in white dominated environments. And I would say that's what makes, you know, being a minority in the United States of America so specifically hard to bear, because you have to be typically, if you're working in corporate America, surrounded by a bunch of white people all day, all night, having to confine yourself to whatever their respectability politics demand. And it's like, that takes a toll. And just removing yourself from that alone, for some people, it's a matter of finding like a Black workplace. For some people like me, it's a matter of going to another country where other people are Black. So your neighbors look like you. So your kids can play in the park with other Black kids and people are not gonna give them a stink face, you know, because it's not a white neighborhood or a white park, right? So that's just like the most important part for me is just being able to escape that white dominance and white gaze in daily life. Like it is so refreshing and exciting and reinvigorating to see a country full of Black and brown people, and nobody is there dictating how they have to wear their hair or how they have to, like, they're just, a lot of people just have their natural hair and it's been like that. A lot of women just, you know, are just Black, and it's just like, oh my God, is this real? And it's really sad, but I realized just not being in white space and in that constant white dominance has been truly like transformative for me. But the last thing I want to say on that subject is that my book is more than just a call for people to leave the United States of America. You know, I told my story to ultimately educate people to what the system of racism is, how it impacts the individual, how it impacts families, like my own family, how it impacted my own family. And it is ultimately a call for reparations, which I call reconciliatory justice, right? Because if America indeed cares to reconcile its relationship with Black people, with Native people, with other people of color, then it must be held accountable for and make amends to these communities that they have destroyed and negatively impacted for centuries. And so I use my story and also the story of my escape to demonstrate what there is to escape from. And in doing so, I'm just really hoping to inspire a bunch of like activism around getting us what we deserve, to help us build these communities we're talking about and help us lean towards that sustainable future we're all imagining, and help us have renewables and garden spaces in countries all over the world where Black folks live. So that's really what my fight is and what my message is.
hard knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard knock. Radio, let's go. Big shout out Anita and Davey D. Feel me? Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio. Kinda crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah.
Ensemble Big Night Woo.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat to the belly from the steel gray beef. Say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to the lovers I need with a please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. You go. Hey, it ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Church of Caesar or Church of Christ, or Reflections on the Other Race. Towards the middle of the 4th century, with the deathbed baptism of Roman Emperor Constantine I, the world, as it was transformed. For if the Roman Empire was Christianized, so too was Christianity imperialized, both transforming the other. I hesitate to conduct these tedious thought experiments of what if, yet one cannot help but consider how this world and Christianity would be if it did not have the imprimatur of the emperor, and thus state power to impose its will on the minds of men. Which brand or flavor of Christian faith would have claimed the hearts of millions? Gnosticism? Arianism? Some other ism that has fallen through the rotted floorboard of time? What would the status of women be if they were not so hideously repressed for generations by the male-dominated forces of church and state? And how much of this repression was built upon sheer misogyny, envy, and jealousy? In the biblical text, the Gospel of Philip, a book excluded from the canon by the Roman church leaders, yet read and revered by early Christians, it was written, "The Savior loved Mary Magdalene more than all the disciples, and kissed her on the mouth often. The other disciples said to him, 'Why do you love her more than all of us?' The Savior answered and said to them, 'Why do I not love you like her?'" In another such verse, from another excluded text, Pistis Sophia, the voice of Mary Magdalene is heard telling Jesus the following, "Peter makes me hesitate. I am afraid of him because he hates the female race." Made thus in Peter's image and not in Mary's, we have the church of power, of keys, of misogyny and empire, instead of Mary's church of love, inclusion, wisdom, and insight. We have the exaltation of men and damnation of women. We have an imperial church. What could have been? What would a Marian church have looked like, one formed in the image of the most beloved of Jesus? Ian Begg, a Jungian analyst and writer on Western mystery religious traditions, is of the view that the Catharist movement, pronounced heretical by the Roman Church and persecuted into oblivion during the early years of church formation and centralization of authority, had a vision deeply at odds with the Roman Church. Of the Cathars, Begg writes, "One of the most remarkable and distinctive features of Catharism, which is shared with some early Gnostic groups, was that women were admitted to their priesthood of parfaits and parfaites. A celebrated example is afforded by Esclermonde of Foix, the owner of Montségur and inspirer of its resistance, who bore 8 children before, with her husband's agreement, she became a parfait. Assuming such a Gnostic expression, which Gibbon informs us was wildly popular and growing in the nascent church, what world would it have given birth to? Such a church, it seems to me, could hardly have waged the terrorist wars it did against women for centuries. We are reminded here that, in the name of stamping out witchcraft, in the 16th and 17th centuries, almost 250,000 women were dunked, drowned, stoned, or, as the saying goes, purified by fire in Europe with the blessings of the Roman Church. Why else would an early church divine announce woman is a temple built over a sewer? Anti-eroticism, misogyny, indeed an anti-natural, anti-life principle prevailed here. Could a body which sacralized the feminine principle, as did the Cathars, and not only as the Divine Mother, have conceived of, much less perpetrated, such hatred and violence against, in Mary Magdalene's words, the female race? Beg argues that Gnostics, from the Greek gnosis, meaning knowledge, constituted a hidden, underground, popular church, which incorporated both Hellenistic and regional influences, which often allowed pre-Christian ideas of female divinity to emerge, often in the form of the Black Virgin cult throughout Europe. The figures reflected two primary influences. The returning crusaders often brought back revered sculptures of a mother and child from the East, and these figures, meant to honor the Comesian deities of Auset and Heru, known in Europe as Egypt's Isis and Horus, brought to mind the images of Mary and Jesus, and also reflected the then-accepted knowledge, gnosis, that such spiritual knowledge came from the ancient civilizations of North Africa. It also occasionally reflected the long pre-Christian European instinct to give obeisances to a goddess, whether Demeter, Artemis, Persephone, or Freya. As we know, this instinct was pronounced anathema and extinguished by sword, fire, thumbscrew, or the rack. It was quieted by terrorism and torture and the edicts of princes and nobles of the robe. It was the road not taken. Empire instead of community. These 2,000 years of male domination over the female